Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello, and welcome to the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast. Today, we will be discussing the pros and cons to age verification in regards to online privacy and children's safety. My name is Elizabeth Dickinson, and I am an assistant director with the Regulatory Transparency Project. As a reminder, all opinions expressed are those of the speakers and not of the Federalist Society. Our moderator today is Jennifer Huddleston, Senior Fellow of Technology Policy at the Cato Institute. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me today, and I'm very excited to talk about this particular issue, an issue that raises a lot of questions and illustrates a lot of the tensions that can occur in different rights and different policy approaches. For example, many people are concerned about what young people may encounter online, but there remains a question of, is there any sort of government role in assisting parents in making those decisions? At the same time, laws that may be designed to protect young people can raise not only questions about those young people's own rights, but about the rights that adults have when it comes to speech and privacy. I'm excited to be joined by three experts today: Claire Morrell, a fellow with the Ethics and Public Policy Center; Bailey Sanchez, the Deputy Director for U.S. Legislation at the Future of Privacy Forum; and Shoshana Weissman, Director of Digital and Media and Communications and a fellow with the R Street Institute. Thank you for joining me today. So to start, I'm going to kick it over to Claire. Claire, we've seen this conversation going on for a couple of years now. What are some of the concerns that have led to this kind of resurgence in the debate over young people online, and particularly this issue of age verification, whether it's for social media in general or for specific types of content online?
Yes, thank you, Jennifer. It's a great question. And by specific portions of content online, I take it to mean you're mainly talking about the age verification laws that have been passing for pornography websites. So I'll just say that what I have spoken and written a lot about is that the technological changes, especially over the last 20 years and even the last 10 years, have really vastly changed the nature of the internet and the harms to children and parents' ability to protect their children. And so I was a contributor to an amicus brief in the Free Speech First Paxson case, which I think we'll get into a little bit later, basically trying to explain to the court that the technology has changed both for the better and for the worse. For the better, in that age verification technologies have advanced, and so that they can now be done in a way that's very anonymous and private for adults. And at the same time, the technology has changed for the worse in making the harms to children so much greater. The smartphone and social media era have given children access to the internet 24/7 in their pockets all the time. The nature of these apps are also meant to be extremely addictive to a young child and their developing brain, with features like recommendation algorithms and infinite scroll and push notifications constantly reminding them to come back and check onto the app. And then the same for pornography websites. They've never been more accessible to children. There are links all over social media, and it's all too easy for a child to get sucked down dangerous rabbit holes or into content or websites that they didn't necessarily mean to. And so studies have shown that 58% of children have been accidentally exposed to internet pornography. So it doesn't mean that they're looking for it, but they're stumbling across a link or something on social media or the internet. And so I try to explain this in the brief that I wrote and in other resources I've put out, that the solution of leaving it up to parents alone to protect their children is not adequate or effective. And this was really not even a disputed matter in the Free Speech Versus Paxson case. The justices were all acknowledging that content filtering has been very ineffective when it comes to pornography websites. And in general, with social media apps as well, the parental controls are very limited. And so the argument that we should just leave it to parents to protect their children, the nature of the technology makes that nearly impossible for parents. And there's countless loopholes and things I could explain, but the main point is that parents really don't have any effective oversight or access to what their children are seeing and doing online. And many of these apps, the kind of app-based ecosystem we find ourselves in, have often block access to external filters or third-party controls that a parent might want to install to try to give them greater control over a child's device or internet use. And so they're often blocked from being able to access those apps. So Snapchat is particularly notorious, and a child can get to Pornhub inside of Snapchat in just 5 clicks. But Snapchat doesn't allow for third-party softwares like Bark or Gab or Circle or some of these other softwares to function inside of their app. And so what's a parent to do? And so these age verification laws that have been passed for pornography websites or age verification and parental consent for social media are trying to actually be an additional layer of protection for parents and to really put power back in parents' hands over what their children are seeing and doing on the internet. So there's a lot more I could say, but I think to summarize, it's just the changes in technology and the smartphone and social media era that we're in and the way these are designed to be incredibly addictive to a child, and the kind of ubiquity and accessibility, particularly of online pornography, which is extremely violent and dehumanizing in nature and not protected speech, particularly not protected speech for children when we're talking about obscenity, all has rendered it very difficult for parents to protect their kids effectively and necessitate the role of the government to step in and provide a solution and to really put the onus back on the pornography websites and the platforms to be age gating their content. So that's what I'll say on that point for now.
And I'm sure our other panelists will want to engage on some of those points as we go on. And as you mentioned, there is a case before the Supreme Court on age verification, and we'll get to why that distinction is important in just a second here. And adult content websites that was heard recently in January of 2025, shortly before we were recording this podcast. But there are also several cases and lower courts involving age verification more generally. We hear a lot of different terms thrown around, sometimes almost accidentally used interchangeably in this conversation, but those distinctions matter a lot if you're a platform trying to decide what to do, or if you're a parent trying to understand what the options may be or what type of things a website or a service may provide to you. So Bailey, I know you've done a lot of work on helping to explain why the terms like age gating, age verification, and age assurance are all slightly different. What should we know about the differences in these terms, and how does that relate to this policy conversation?
Sure. So the way I think about age assurance is that it's an umbrella term for a spectrum of technology for determining someone's age. So you have on the lowest end of the spectrum, you have that like self-declaration or self-attestation where you're literally just checking a box that might say, you know, I'm 21 and up, or you're entering your birth date. And that's kind of where the age gate, age screen concept comes from. And then on the higher end, you have someone checking your ID or other like official credentials to verify your age. So a lot of innovation right now is in kind of the middle category, what I call age estimation. So for example, that might be software that kind of takes a picture of your face and looks at how old you are, or estimates how old you are based on a picture of your face. And I think that distinction is important, you know, regardless of what we call it. Really, the question for compliance with companies is they want to know how certain they need to be and what like level of risk or what level of accuracy they need to have, depending on the liability under the law. So if a law is very, very strict and has very, very high penalties, they're going to want to have very, very high accuracy and probably want to check your ID. Whereas like if a law, the penalties are kind of more flexible, they might say, you know, the self-declaration is appropriate and self-declaration is the one that I think we're most familiar with. I think people that are more critical in general of age verification kind of are skeptical that there's a distinction between age estimation and age verification. But I do think the like framework that I just laid out is helpful for kind of understanding the various technologies at play and their trade-offs in efficacy and in privacy. I think it's important to keep in mind that there's a conversation to be had from like the technology perspective, like what can the technology do? And then one from the policy perspective of like, when is it a good idea to deploy this technology? I see a lot of parallels between this and facial recognition technology. So facial recognition technology has grown really sophisticated over the years. So some of those critiques that were focused on, you know, this technology doesn't work or it's really biased, like that has been mitigated some over the years. But there, I think we could all agree there's still significant policy questions to answer about when it is appropriate to deploy facial recognition technology. So again, I think having those two parallel conversations is very important.
Thank you. You know, this topic really exists as an overlap between a couple of different regulatory transparency project working groups, particularly the Emerging Technology Working Group, but also the Data Privacy and Cybersecurity Working Group. Shoshana, oftentimes when we have these conversations, we're really focused on the harms, the harms to young people that they might encounter certain types of information online before they're ready for it or when their parents aren't aware of it. But in the past, you've done a lot of work discussing the benefits of technology for young people. But you've also done a lot of work talking about some of the unique privacy risks that young people may encounter online. Would age verification make this situation for young people online better or worse, in your opinion?
For sure. So I think that there's definitely bad ways for kids to use social media and a lot of online tools, but there's also really good ways like GitHub. Kids can learn to code on there. I'm often there trying to learn code poorly, but trying really hard to learn code. And AllTrails too is technically social media and would be covered by a majority of these bills. But it's just, there's nothing really bad on there. You just go there to find hiking and stuff like that. And I started in politics when I was a teenager networking with elected officials on Facebook. So for me, I want to make sure we don't close the door behind us to make sure that the next generation has these opportunities. I learned so much through social media, even to, finding out that I had fibromyalgia from an online forum, that would have had to be age gated under these laws. But I typed in endometriosis and getting sick all the time. And like by this time, 25 doctors had missed it. And some random online forum said, hey, if you're getting sick a lot and you have endometriosis, you might want to look into fibromyalgia. And I made an appointment with a rheumatologist and he's like, yeah, you definitely have fibromyalgia. And for me, that was just such an invaluable opportunity to find out more about my health. And with, especially with health, information's always evolving. A lot of medical tests aren't being done on women. So the way that a lot of people who are being ignored by the medical community sometimes figure stuff out is by forums. And it sounds silly, but it really can be helpful for a lot of us, and especially in my case. And then, you know, even if parents are okay with their kids being online and don't mind the risks of age verification, you know, if they don't really see it as a problem, there's still the problem that the biggest age verifier for tech companies leaked all their data for over a year and a half. It was appalling. Like this report from 404 Media showed that they actually contacted the company and said, hey, you know, you're leaving this data open. We have the credentials and we're in the system. And only after saying we're in the system did they actually fix the problem. So if they had said, oh, we fixed the problem and the reporter stepped away, it would have still been open to this date. And I know that there's different kinds of age verification systems. There's a lot of different methods for it. But the fact that the favored one by everyone from TikTok to Twitter, at the time, I think it was technically Twitter, to Bumble and a lot of other tech companies was using it is extremely concerning, because the reality of how this works matters, which is why during the court hearings, when Alito said, well, everyone's hacked, that's part of the issue here. And it's really dangerous for children. I've been working with a child welfare expert here to understand the issue, because I didn't really understand until I started working on this, the risk of child identity theft. I'm like, kids don't have money, you know, what's the risk there? But when I dove into it, I found out that the IRS knows of hundreds of thousands of cases of employment fraud using children's credentials, and they don't tell parents. Social security numbers aren't checked for identity theft before they're, or for fraud and for crimes before they're issued to kids. And it's a really big problem. The stats also show that kids are more frequent victims of identity theft. While they lose less money, they lose money more often. in a lot of cases. And it can be a really big risk to kids, and not to say there's not other sources of it, but if every person has to upload their identification online in order to access services, there really is a bigger risk here when we're already in a bad spot to begin with. So before we even get here, I'd really like the government to address these things. The IRS is well aware of the issue, but they just have chosen not to solve it. I don't think the Social Security Administration has worked as much here, but part of the real core problem here is when it's about parental consent, you have to make sure that the parent is the parent and the child is the child in each case. And that can require a lot more identifying information. So for me, I want to make sure that kids are able to access useful information. I'm all for parental filters. And some of them are pretty comprehensive, especially at the app store level and at the device level. But I'm also really worried about identity theft for everyone, but especially kids who then go on to not being able to get loans for college and other opportunities.
So I want us to kind of talk about some of the more specific scenarios that we've seen evolve, as well as some of the legal questions at play here. As was mentioned, there is currently a case before the Supreme Court, Free Speech Coalition v. Paxton, that has to do with the age verification requirements in Texas for adult sexual content websites. But we've also seen several states pass more general age verification laws for social media or age-appropriate design codes. While the specifics of these laws vary, in general, we've seen them enjoined by lower courts on speech grounds. So I was wondering if the panel could talk a bit about what have the courts found when it comes to the privacy and speech concerns for adults as it relates to age verification laws. And as the Supreme Court directly asked in oral arguments in Free Speech Coalition v. Paxton, does the panel believe that age verification could ever be constitutional?
Can I jump in really fast? Just respectfully, just to like frame everything very clearly, while yes, like some lower courts have enjoined some of these laws, I think it has flown under the radar that a lot of laws have actually gone into effect. So Louisiana and Utah have age verification for porn website laws in effect. Florida and South Carolina, their laws just kicked in January 1st. Virginia's law has been in effect. I saw Kansas is bringing a lawsuit against some of these major porn companies under their law. And then on the social media front, Louisiana has a law in effect. Florida's and Tennessee's just took effect. And so there are actually laws that have not been enjoined. And then also at the circuit court level, which is how it's made its way all the way up to the Supreme Court with the Texas age verification law, obviously the Fifth Circuit upheld Texas's age verification law. More recently, the Sixth Circuit upheld Tennessee's age verification law. And so I think it is worth noting that while some district courts may have enjoined these laws, that not all of them have been enjoined. In fact, some courts have ruled that these laws are constitutional. And so I know I'm going first on this question. So I just will also say that I think what was spoken about a lot in the Free Speech v. Paxton oral arguments that I was in the courtroom for, where a lot of the justices were asking that question, like of the petitioners in the case, the attorney for the petitioners, you know, is there ever a scenario where age verification could be constitutional? The attorney really tried to dodge that question by trying to just say that content filtering is more effective, but the justices really weren't buying it. And they really pushed back across the board, both that filters have been ineffective. That was kind of an indisputable fact in the case. None of the justices were really convinced otherwise. And I would say the other thing that they all really acknowledged, you know, maybe with the exception of two of the justices, but I would say seven of them really acknowledged that the changes in technology mean that age verification can now be done in ways that are anonymous and protective of user privacy. And so I do think it's important to recognize that there is a way for these laws to be constitutional, that they don't restrict necessarily adults' speech or access to speech. And so I would say what was really at issue in the Paxton case was what standard of review should be applied. That was what most of the debate kind of focused on in the courtroom. And I would say a lot of these other things around the technology It seemed pretty widely accepted by the court that age verification can now be done in ways that are anonymous and protective of adult privacy, and that the nature of technology has changed to render content filters very ineffective in the era of smartphones and social media. And we can unpack more on that case, but I just wanted to say to your initial question, can this be done constitutionally? I think the answer is definitely yes. And that some of these laws are in fact in effect and have been already upheld.
I think Claire's reframing of the question is an important point because, you know, we're talking about the technology of age verification, but whether it's deployed for porn or for social media, I think is going to end up making a difference as these cases make their way through the courts. I think the porn one, we will get some resolution. We will learn more very soon. Whereas like whether age verification is appropriate for social media, I think is a lot further down the road and getting questions on just because social media has been around a lot less than porn has, quite frankly. And that question of its impacts to kids are certainly relevant. And so I think it is worth noting that I think generally the social media age verification laws are more enjoined than in effect, whereas like the adult content, like the porn ones, it's kind of hit or miss. Notably though, Jennifer, you brought up the question of like, you know, like why some have gone into effect, why some have been enjoined. The Tennessee one, the Tennessee porn age verification law just recently went into effect. And part of the court's reason was like, well, if Texas and another state get to have theirs in effect, like why not us while the... while the Supreme Court gives us further guidance. And then regarding the social media cases, some of those were not enjoined strictly because of age verification, but because of like other questions. Like in Arkansas, that was a really interesting one because there were a lot of questions about just like who this applies to. Because if we all were asked to, you know, give a definition of what social media is, I think we all might have a different answer. And that was the case in Arkansas. Like there was one company that was that testified, and the state did not agree whether or not that company would be in scope of the law. So I think usually with social media laws, the reason they get enjoined is because they're not narrowly tailored. I mean, that gets into the age verification question, but also other aspects of the law. And then I think that is going to be a very live question for Free Speech Coalition versus Paxton, because as Claire alluded to, really the question before the court was what level of scrutiny applies. And I think it's interesting that there might be a different level of scrutiny for kids and teens than for adults, because again, these are laws that are meant to protect kids, but they do have impacts on adults. And Free Speech Coalition was very clear and was like, you know, we're not here to represent the rights of kids and teens. We're not disputing that porn harms them. What we are here to discuss is what the impact is on adults. And so I think that's an important distinction as well, is I don't think people are necessarily advocating, you know, like we want kids to have more access to porn. What the issue is like, what are the disproportionate impacts on adults that are impacted by these laws to protect children?
And on my end, just by reading prior precedent, I'd be surprised if the court sided against the Free Speech Coalition, only not even my analysis, but just based on what I've seen from prior court decisions and how, and their issues with both filtering being better than age verification and the problems with age verification, just because I really still do see it as still an evolving technology that has enough holes where, you know, the one that all the companies go for, like, is leaking data left and right. I do think one day, though, that we're going to get better age verification services that I think are a little bit more solid. It's funny, a lot of people on my side disagree with me there, but I really do think it's going to happen one day. And I don't know how. I'm not smart enough to figure out exactly how, but I think it's going to happen. And I think when that happens, I think the porn age verification laws will fly by fine. But for the social media ones, I think it's more complex because all of that is, or almost all of it, is First Amendment protected speech for everyone. There's definitely exceptions to it, but generally when it's large swaths of First Amendment protected speech, the scrutiny is a lot harder. And a lot of these laws are just written really broadly and poorly, as Bailey was kind of talking about, where you know, they'll exempt some services, but not others. And there's really no clear reason why to create that distinction between the services. or they'll exempt some companies, but not others. And part of the problem is some of the smaller companies do more harm or create more problems. But when you have the like the financial limit or the user limit, it kind of gets by there, which is a strange problem with some of these laws. But then some small companies are great and you put all these extra burdens on them that they can't possibly comply with. All that plus the states also themselves don't seem to be grappling well with the best way to do age verification in general, whether it's age assurance or age estimation. It's just when you read these laws, you can tell that they're struggling to figure out the best way to do it to protect privacy, but also ensure compliance. And I get that it's no easy task, but I think until age verification systems are in a stronger place and not only more secure, but more accurate and less easy to get around, it's just going to be hard to write these laws to get by scrutiny in general, outside of the question of, kids and accessing social media. But I do think it'll get to the place where porn age verification laws end up being constitutional. I just think it might take a little bit to get there, or I could be wrong and the case is ruled against me, who knows, but that's kind of where I'm coming from.
Well, and as Claire pointed out, we have seen in other district courts, particularly age verification for adult content, that was perhaps a bit more narrowly tailored. And I will admit the tailoring was part of my problem with throwing out such a broad question, because there are so many different things that you guys could think about. And on that note, I'm not surprised that we have some more thoughts. So Bailey, I think you had something else to add to this conversation.
Yeah, so one of your questions was like, can this be constitutional? And I'm not going to give like the answer to like yes or no, but I did want to point out that this like porn age verification trend kind of started. Well, it started again. Of course, we've had this kind of like tech debate like 10, 20 years ago, but it started a couple of years ago. Louisiana passed theirs, and then the next session is when other states started to do so. But what made Louisiana different is that they had a digital ID system that they had in place since, I believe, 2016. It's like a kind of small, weird digital ID, I will say. I don't know if it's like a model every state wants to replicate, but they had something that they could kind of like easily incorporate into this debate. They had digital ID, but other states don't. So Utah was the first one to copy it, very similar to what Louisiana passed, but Utah did not have a digital ID. So the way it worked in Louisiana is you have your ID on this app. The app has already kind of like verified your credentials. So when you go to Pornhub or another site, all you do is kind of like send in those, you don't send in the credential, you send in kind of like a token that's like thumbs up, this person is over 18 and can access. So they're not getting who you are, and they're not getting your exact age. So that is a little more privacy protective. But of course, not every state has that. And then of course, if you're going to rely on digital ID as a mechanism, you need to make sure there are appropriate digital ID standards in place, appropriate digital ID security practices. Again, I mentioned this is kind of like a weird little app that Louisiana has. There's some interesting backstory on it. But I thought that was really interesting because Louisiana's law, I believe, went under the radar for a while before it was challenged.
And Claire, before we move on to the next question, I'm going to go back to you since you kind of kicked it all off and see if you have anything else to respond.
Oh, thank you. I don't want to take up too much more time. I know we have other things to get to. Also, Bailey just made one of the points I was going to make. So thank you, because I was going to just say, I think sometimes it's helpful to talk about specific examples. And Louisiana's Louisiana Wallet is an amazing technology they've used that you don't reveal any information about yourself to the website, only whether or not you are over 18 or under 18. And it takes less than 30 seconds. And like she mentioned, you can just generate a code. In fact, Pornhub, because they don't want to lose business, has been like advertising Louisiana Wallet. Like, don't worry, this process will take less than 45 seconds. And so I think it's pretty clear that these methods can be very anonymous for adults. I did just want to push back on one thing that I think we can't lose here. And this is something that Justice Gorsuch really drove home in the case, which is that we should not have one constitutional regime that governs the real world and a different one that governs the internet world. And if we have already accepted age verification for brick and mortar establishments, that we're not going to let children just buy pornographic magazines or go into strip clubs, the same should be applied in the online world. And it was best, like, our goal should be to make those regimes as equal as possible, not to have a vastly different constitutional regime for the internet And in fact, this has been pointed out in some of the amicus briefs filed in the case, like showing an ID in person, you're revealing a lot more information about yourself. They see your name, your birth date. Whereas with Louisiana Wallet, it's literally just whether or not you are over or under 18. And so I think there actually the technology has advanced so much that these methods online can even be more privacy protecting than methods in the real world. And so I think it's just, it's worth noting that distinction. And I just want to also bring up, like, I think it was mentioned, this is, we have to consider the impact on adult speech. But in these cases, who's bringing the case against these laws? These are giant pornography companies. Adults are not suing, saying, I don't have access to the pornography that I want to have. Therefore, I'm going to file a lawsuit against these laws. But in fact, it's the businesses. And I think it's just important in remembering, like, who are we trying to protect in America? Are we trying to protect children or giant pornography companies that are worth around like $97 billion globally? That have a predatory business model that operates by trying to addict its users, including their young, including the youngest users. And they don't really care if they're catching young children in the wide nets that they're casting in advertising their products all over social media, where a child can easily stumble upon it. And so I do think it is worth noting that the Free Speech Coalition is actually the pornography industry. And so I know that they argue in a lot of their cases that this is for free speech access for adults, but I do think we have to remember there's a business model behind it. And so these are not just neutral actors. They are a for-profit business. And that is why they are suing against these laws, because it's a threat to those profits. And so I do just want to call that out. Okay. Sorry, now I yield back my time.
And this actually is a great way to lead into the next topic I wanted to get into, which is going to move us a bit away from the kind of age verification for adult sexual content websites or porn websites, because some of these laws, of course, are broader than just obscenity or pornography, and look at kind of more the general question of age verification, particularly when we see debates around age verification for more general purpose websites, whether it's social media or the internet as a whole, as was kind of discussed. Oftentimes, there's not a widely agreed upon definition of social media. We've seen this not only in the U.S., but around the world in places like the U.K. with the online safety bill, as well as in Australia with the potential social media ban for under 16s, if I recall correctly there. But this raises a lot of questions around some of the tensions that would naturally occur, whether it's the questions around cybersecurity for this data or questions around the ability to engage in anonymous speech online, which can be particularly important in certain ways. So I'd like to ask our panel, are there particular groups who age verification could benefit, or particular groups who might have specific types of concerns around the privacy or speech issues for age verification? And if so, why? And is there anything that policymakers should think about when it comes to these trade-offs? And I'm going to start with Shoshana, since she went last time.
For sure. So I did have to say LA Wallet had a big data breach. So maybe, like, let's not look at them for the big example. But it's actually interesting. The data breach was through a secondary company that was connected to a bunch of government agencies. So it's kind of like a more of a government wide thing. Like, it's not the LA Wallet in particular. But to that end, it's, you know, if you're searching on forums and maybe posting about wanting to get a divorce or trying to avoid divorce, that's really sensitive stuff that you probably don't want people to know. And you can always talk to people close to you, but sometimes the internet is a good way to get information and feedback on stuff. Addiction is another thing that you wouldn't want people to know that you're posting about. You probably wouldn't even sometimes want your friends or family to know about it. There's really safe, smart ways to get information online that's, you know, not perfect, but sometimes you can really find those communities. People often talk about the LGBT community as well, but there's also just so many sensitive kinds of things that you can search about and post about online where you're kind of glad to be anonymous. Other family issues. I have a mental illness in my family, and dealing with that as a kid was hard. And as I was older, I found other people who had family members with mental illness, and it was nice. But it's something where I kind of wish back in the day I had posted online about it and asked about it, but anonymously, so not to embarrass anyone. But there's so many different, like, anyone in a vulnerable spot who's maybe even facing domestic abuse. I mean, there's so many different kinds of people where if you have to verify your information before going on, it can really put you at risk. And it's something that some people in the domestic violence community have posted about with regard to age verification laws here. But there's also just endless, you know, reasons why you wouldn't want your personal information tied to you online. That I think it's worth thinking about. And it's a reason we have anonymous speech as a right in the Constitution. I know it's not written out, but precedent has over and over again enforced that that we have that right to speak without, you know, without identification. And I think that applies online and in the real world as well. And it's worth thinking about, you know, when people have to give up their information, what speech activity are we not going to see? Who are people who need help or aren't going to get that help? I think there's a lot of examples like that.
Yeah. Really? So I would say that obviously this disproportionately impacts adults. I don't think anyone is arguing that there is no burden on adults. The goal here is to kind of, it's very explicitly focused on protecting kids and teens. So kids and teens are kind of receiving the benefit of this regulation. The question really is just like, you know, is the burden small, but it's like worth the trade-off. And it's kind of presumed, I think, that the burden on adults is worth it to achieve that goal. And I definitely hear the comparisons to like in-person use cases, but just giving Florida as an example, Florida is where I live. Florida, ironically, is a state where I do not have access to Pornhub anymore. But if I want to go into a Publix and buy alcohol, like the law here is if you look under 40, you have to show an ID. And so, you know, I like to still be carded because that means that people think I look under 40, I am under 40. But anyone that's over 40, you know, they're not getting ID'd at all. And that law is in place to kind of like, you know, set a high bar for people, Publix workers, but not make it to where, you know, like your 90-year-old grandma is getting carded. On the internet, there's kind of presumed that you can kind of like be online anonymously, as Shoshana alluded to. And there's not really a good way to do that initial check, though that is kind of what Yodi's technology is focused on. Yodi, someone that does like the facial age estimation. Yodi is not giving you an exact age. They're just saying, hey, you look under 25, you look over 25. And so on that point, the people that are more burdened by these laws are the ones that are in that like kind of 18 to 25 group. They might have to go through a more rigorous age verification process. I think adults that are like, you know, 18 or 19 might have the most burdens placed on them. And then I think I would also add just like the chilling effect of providing a government issued ID, especially in a state that doesn't have digital ID. Even if you do have an ID, those that do not, you know, we are in a place where, you know, we just had a big change in administration. A lot of states have changed over. There's a lot happening politically in the country beyond like the tech policy bubble we're in. And so people just maybe don't feel comfortable providing their government issued information over the internet. Especially dependent on what state you are in. And so I think there are also some adults, you know, Shoshana talked about like when you are a teen, you want to have access to the internet and you might have rights that are differently situated from someone under 13. But here, I think like the biggest group that is impacted is adults and no one's disputing that. And it's just a matter of like, is that trade-off appropriate or not? Is the technology sufficiently sophisticated that it's a minimal trade-off and we are kind of all happy with that?
I'll just jump in quickly because I know I don't want to take up too much time. Those are, I'm good. Yeah, grateful to hear those answers from Bailey and Shoshana. I just wanted to respond to a couple things. I think that a group that's getting overlooked in this whole conversation are parents. So parents are a huge group of adults. And I don't know if all of my fellow panelists or any of you are parents or know parents. But in my line of work, I speak to hundreds of parents all the time, and they are in desperate need of help to protect their kids better online. And these are parents who are doing everything. They have downloaded all the filters. They have set up all the parental controls. They are constantly trying to check their kids' devices. And so, and they just feel helpless to actually be able to effectively protect and oversee their children in the online world. And so I think that we have to remember that parents really want these laws and that these lawmakers aren't just passing these laws because their constituents don't care about them. They are motivated to pass these because they are hearing from their constituents that parents need better tools to protect their kids online, and they need better backup because of the reasons I mentioned earlier, that the filters and parental controls are not effective, and that this idea of parental controls is largely a myth, that the parents are not given real oversight or access into what their kids are seeing and doing online. And on that note, I would just say, like, I think Shoshana maybe mentioned like children's identities being compromised or kind of child privacy. I think that is one of the biggest concerns that parents have. And that's why they don't want a child to just be able to go and create a social media account without their consent, because these companies are collecting massive amounts of their children's data and they're not able to actually effectively oversee that. And so I do think I'm actually in favor of these laws because I think they are more protective of children and their privacy. And these laws would not be IDing children in the sense that they would be asking for adults to verify their age. And that doesn't even need to be in the form of ID. That was another point I wanted to bring up, is a lot of these laws give multiple options for adults to verify their age. And so if they don't have a government issued ID, like you mentioned, Bailey, there would be alternative ways for them to verify their age or identity. But I think we have to remember that the point of these laws is to be very protective of children. And I think the nature of the online world today is that there is massive amounts of data being collected all the time on adults and on children. And that what we're trying to argue for in these laws is just verifying for pornography websites, whether or not this person is an adult. And so the only information that is necessary is whether or not they're over 18. And then when it comes to social media, the social media laws that I've worked on are age verification, but tied to parental consent. So it's not just age verification to completely block children from social media, but rather trying to actually put parents back in the driver's seat in terms of whether or not their kids get on social media. Because if the solution is we should just leave it up to parents to protect their kids, they could do everything to protect their children. But if a child can just create a social media account by just saying they're a certain age and entering a birthday and clicking a box, then 8 to 12-year-old kids could be all of their social media, even though it's supposed to be over 13. And so I think that parents are just really fighting an uphill battle, and they want to protect their kids online and they want to protect their children's privacy. They don't want tech companies to have all this information amassed on their children, which you mentioned data breaches. Like that's a very real concern for a parent. And so again, I think that we have some mutual goals. And so I do think that these laws are constitutional, and that the impact on adults can be extremely minimal, if anything. Like I really think that this process can take less than 45 seconds for an adult, but it can be incredibly effective at keeping children off of these things, either without parental consent or, in the case of obscenity, just off of these websites because they're unsafe for children.
Well, there's certainly plenty more we could discuss. And, you know, hopefully maybe after that decision comes down in the Free Speech Coalition v. Paxson case, we can all hop back on the podcast and talk about what that means in regards to what happens next. So I want to thank Claire, Shoshana, and Bailey for joining me today. And I will hand it back over to Elizabeth from the Federalist Society Regulatory Transparency Project to say a few words and close us out.
Awesome. Thanks, Jennifer. What a great conversation. Thank you all so much for tuning in today. And thank you again to all of our experts for sharing their insight and opinions. If you're interested in learning more about our programming, discussing the regulatory state and the American way of life, please visit our website at regproject.org. That is regproject.org. Thank you.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.